Satellite Channel 0131. This is BBC 7.
It's the Little Toe Show.
Hello again. You're just in time to join me, Kirsten O'Brien, and me 10 Tootsies for Tuesday's Little Toe Show. Is there anybody there? I can't hear anyone wiggling. Ah, that's better. Now we're all together, I can tell you what treats I've got for you today. We'll be opening up the gate to Wiggly Park soon, where there's a buzz in the air. Then we'll be joining Annie Fidgen. She's the girl in our new story, It's Only Annie, by Tony and Jan Payne. In about a quarter of an hour, we're off to Africa to meet Akimbo and the Crocodile Man in another new story by Alexander McCall Smith. And after that, Fergus Crane is back for more adventures. And in about three quarters of an hour, we can catch up with Black Beauty in Anna Sewell's classic story. Wow, Toes, there's plenty to wiggle at today. We'd better get our skates on and begin.
We're always wiggling on Little Toe.
We've tiptoed into Keith Faulkner's Wiggly Park for today's first story. There's a bit of a buzz in the air down there, and Nifty's very excited. But will there be a sting in the tail for the garden gang? Let's find out.
It seemed a little bit warmer as EW, the earthworm, Shelley, the French snail, and Nifty, the slug, took their morning wiggle around the rose garden in Wiggly Park.
Ah, just smell that, Nifty, old chum, said EW, taking a deep breath.
Smell what? I can't smell nothing.
I can't smell anything, corrected Shelley.
Oh, there you go, EW. Shelley can't smell nothing neither.
Oh, no, no, I mean the air. It, smells like spring coming. Ha ha! Don't you think so? What?
Oh, may we? I think that you're right, EW.
I don't know about smelling, but I can hear a funny buzzing noise,
said the slug, stopping and listening carefully.
Buzzing? I can't hear it. Oh, yes, you're right. There is a sort of buzzing.
I can hear it too. I wonder where it is coming from. Perhaps it is Diggins.
Diggins? Oh, Diggins doesn't buzz, does he?
No, no, not Diggins himself. No, no, Shelley means Diggins using a mower or hedge cutters, you know.
As they listened, the buzzing got louder and louder. Gazing over the hedge towards the bandstand, EW suddenly shouted,
Swarm!
Nifty nodded.
Yeah, we know it's swarm. You already said that, EW.
No, 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 you twerp. Swarm of bees, look!
There in the sky, high above the bandstand, was what looked like a small black cloud.
Oh, do you think that they are dangerous, EW?
Well, I don't mind old Buzz on his own, but a whole swarm of bees, well, I really don't know, Shelley.
Oh, Lummox, I'll tell you what, we'll find out soon, because they're coming this way.
Oh, quick, you two, into the flower pot. I'm not waiting to find out.
The three of them slithered through the little hole and into EW's flower pot.
Right, block the hole with some earth and, hey, presto, we're safe and sound, ha! Whew.
They huddled together in the dark. They waited for something to happen. After a while, the buzzing got louder and louder until it sounded as though it was just outside the flower pot.
Oh, Lummy, they're right outside.
But I can hear a voice. Yes, it's someone calling. Perhaps all, EW.
EW dug some of the earth away from the hole. Buzz scrambled in to join them.
What, oh, it's only me. Oh, I say, what a day.
I say, jolly good to see you, Buzz. What on earth is going on?
Well, the hive got a bit crowded, don't you know? So one of the young queens decides to fly off to build a new hive, and bingo!
And bingo what, Buzz?
Bingo! Half the chaps swarm off with her. Total shambles, what I can tell you.
But where will they go, Buzz?
Who knows? It could be anywhere. Well, anywhere that's a good place for a new hive.
Oh, lummox, I hope they don't choose my compost heap. I don't want to share my bed with a trillion bees. I'd never get no sleep.
After a while, it was all quiet again outside.
Now, let's take a look outside now. Out!
They crept out of the flower pot and looked around. Everything was quiet and peaceful. Not a bee in sight. Well, except for Buzz, of course.
Yes, I can't see them. They must have gone off somewhere else.
Oh, I jolly well hope so. I like you, Buzz, but swarms make me a bit nervous.
Well, we're okay now, Nifty.
E.W. tried to reassure the worried slug.
Well, they could be anywhere, you know, waiting to pounce.
Oh, Nifty, stop it. You're starting to make me nervous, too.
Yes, well, can't be too careful, you know. A swarm can be dangerous, don't you know? That is, if you're not a bee.
Oh, thanks a lot, Buzz, old chap. That makes us feel a lot better.
Right, duty calls. I'd best fly back and get things organized, what?
Said Buzz, as he took off.
Well, I'm not going back to the vegetable garden. Not on my own, I'm not.
All right. We'll come with you.
So they slithered up the steps and out of the rose garden, across the path, and cautiously into the vegetable garden, glancing nervously about as they went.
Yeah, it seems quiet enough to me.
They didn't know that Winston Diggins, the park gardener, was in the shed, and he was just filling up his chainsaw with petrol, ready to cut up some logs.
Yes, nothing to fear here now, Nifty.
There's not a bee in sight.
Yeah, well, if they was around here, we'd hear them all right, wouldn't we?
Anyway, who's afraid of a few little bees, eh? We're jolly well not, are we?
Just then, in the shed, Diggins pulled the starter on his chainsaw, and it roared into life. E.W. gave a terrified shriek.
Ah, they're coming!
And they all dived headfirst into the compost heap.
You know, I'm not keen on bees. Best to keep away and watch them keeping busy. We'll be back in Keith Fauntler's Wiggly Park tomorrow for another adventure. The stories are read by Andrew Sachs.
It's time for another story.
It's the Little Chow Show.
In 10 minutes, we're off to Africa to meet Akimbo and the Crocodile Man. But now, I'd really like you to meet a friend of mine. Her name is Annie Fidgen, but you can call her Annie. Today, Annie is joining the Brownies. It's Only Annie is written by Tony and Jan Payne.
Why is cleaning out my room such a big thing? I like all my stuff where I can see it. On the floor and on my bed. It's not as if anyone wants to go in my room except me. Dad makes the bed most of the time, and sometimes brings in the Hoover. But I don't think he really knows much about hoovering. He can switch it on, but then spends more time trying to figure out what the knobs are for than actually doing anything.
What does this little drawing mean, then? He asked once, as if I'd know. It looks as if I'm supposed to throw the Hoover out of the window.
Go on, then, I said. That would be more interesting than watching him wave it around the middle of the carpet like he normally does. There's more dust around after he's cleaned up. That can't be right, he said. I think I'll just throw the carpet over the washing line and beat it up with a stick. That's what your grandmother had to do when she was a girl. He meant Gran Weatherburn. I have another granny, Granny Fidgen, who is very posh and has never ever had to clean a carpet. Gran was a girl a really, really long time ago. But even though she's old now and has veins on the outside of her legs, she knows how to use a hoover and how to take one to bits and put it back together again. Dad's not good with housework, though, or machines. But he's good with computers, I think. Your grandmother used to be in the Brownies, he said. She got brownie points and 5p for doing things like washing up and cleaning her room and beating carpets. 5p for a whole room! Then Dad looked at me and his eyes lit up and I knew what he was thinking. No, Dad, I pleaded. Yes, Annie, he said. It's the brownies for you. It's just not fair, I never join anything. I don't want to be with a lot of other kids. I like just being me. On the day Dad thought of this brilliant idea to get rid of me by packing me off to the Brownies, Mum was off on one of her adventures. Otherwise, I might have got out of it. Mum's got a guilty conscience because she's not around more. So when she is home, I usually get my own way. She was home the day the Brownies met, though, so she took me in her car. It's an old French car, made of plastic. It doesn't have any sides or back, and it's got a cloth roof. It sounds like it's doing 200 miles an hour, but someone could overtake it pushing a piano. So Mum says. She loves it to bits. The Brownies' place was really just a big wooden hut, and over the doors and windows were flags of different countries put out to dry on a washing line. Mum gave me a hug and dropped me off outside and drove off, to Russia this time. A smiley lady wearing a big school uniform and socks rushed over when I walked in. She said she was called Brown Owl, which was a silly name, I thought. I had to stand in front of everybody and say who I was and where I came from. I was the only one there not wearing a uniform. Mrs. Owl gave me some paper and magazine-y things and sent me to sit at a bright red and blue table to look at them. There was a blank sheet of paper and I was supposed to write down things about myself, what my favourite colour was and stuff like that. What were my interests? I couldn't think of any. I've got too many things to do to have interests. Then I looked at the magazine. It had the uniforms and stuff, and they weren't bad. There was a nice gilet top, a hoodie and a baseball cap. But no way was I going to wear something called a skort. Also, I didn't like the colour. It was bright yellow. I'd look like a road mender in a bright yellow gilet. Over the page, it showed some of the things that Brownies and Guides did. This was more like it. There was go-karting, snorkeling, pony trekking, canoeing, all sorts of cool things. I'd be doing some of the things Mum does. Quad biking, rock climbing, hang gliding. Well, I didn't think I could do all those things straight away. Maybe next month. But I couldn't wait to find out what we'd be doing this evening. I asked Mrs. Owl and she said we were all going to learn the proper way to wash our feet. I thought she must be joking. What about scuba diving and stuff, I asked. It's very important to take care of your feet, said Mrs. Owl, still smiling. She was never not smiling. We do all these activities in the brochure on special outings, but you can't do any of them if your feet aren't healthy. Don't forget we have the parade on Saturday. You're going to need your feet. I didn't know there was going to be a parade, I said. Ah, well, this is a very special year for us, Annie. It's our 90th birthday, and this weekend the Guides and Brownies are having a grand parade together. Cubs and Scouts will be having theirs as well, as we all share the same birthday. There'll be colourful floats and marching bands and all sorts of wonderful things. Even the Band of the Royal Marines will be coming. The television cameras will be there, and this is the best bit, Annie. Our little troop will be right at the front of the procession. Won't that be fun? Well, yes, more fun than feet washing lessons, definitely. We still had to do that, though, and draw on the floor around our feet with a felt-tip pen, and then look at pictures of the shoes our feet like best. Mrs. Out asked me what my main interest was, so that I could have a badge. I chose cloth dyeing, you know, dyeing cloth different colours. Okay, I know I couldn't think of anything before, but I had to pick something, even if my main interest wasn't that interesting. By the time we packed up, I'd learned how to wash my feet, tie a knot, written all about me, and joined in a powwow. I was dying to be let out when Gran came to pick me up. I went with her to Wesson's department store the next day to get my Brownie uniform. When I got home, I looked up the instructions for my new interest, cloth dyeing. Then I shoved the uniform into the washing machine and added the coloured dye I'd bought. I wanted a blue uniform, but when their clothes had finished whizzing round at last, I'd got a green one instead. That was all right. I wouldn't look like everyone else. That was the most important thing. On Saturday, I went to the parade meeting. Mrs. Owl looked amazed by my nice green uniform, But Annie, it's not our pack's colour, she wailed. You said I could choose the clothes I wore if they were in the book, I said. Yes, but not if they're a different colour. Oh dear, what are we going to do with you? The procession starts in a few minutes, and there's no time to find other clothes. She looked at me, thinking hard. We're going straight up the high street to Hingham Park. It couldn't be simpler. Do you think you could lead the parade, she asked. Yes, I said. That's easy. Good girl. People will think you're dressed differently because you're at the front, the leader of the pack. I'll be at the back with another group, I'm afraid, so I won't be able to keep an eye on you, but I know you'll be fine. A big pack of guides arrived then, and some other brownie packs, and then the floats were lined up ready to go. There were a lot of them. One looks like a big purple dragon on wheels, tossing his head and breathing out flames and smoke. It was playing a little jingly tune. We all knew it was Mr. Alexander's ice cream van in disguise, because he can't turn off his jingle, and people round here know it well. Drinks were handed round before we started, and everyone was given a huge tub of sweets. It was getting exciting, actually. The soldiers' band was right behind us. Its huge bass drum got us going. Boom, 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 boom. Then the rest of the drummers began tapping away and the other instruments started playing. The noise was amazing. And I was right at the front. Annie first, yeah. I had to walk fast because the band kept bashing into us if I didn't. I walked in the centre of the road, waving to the crowds and turning round and round so I could see what the others were doing and do what they did. I really got into it. The tub of sweets was for throwing into the crowd, and I was very fair dishing them out. One for them, one for me. But then I had a problem. The high street is quite long, and I'd had a lot to drink. I was dying for a pee. I tried to hold on, but it was getting serious. I yelled to the brownie behind to keep going, and that I'd catch up later. Then I dashed into the main hall of the big supermarket we were going past. There was a queue at the toilet, and I was desperate by the time I could go, but I could still hear the band quite loudly, so I knew they hadn't got too far ahead. I was in for an enormous shock when I came out. The parade had followed me into the supermarket! All the brownies and guides were milling about, not knowing what to do, and most of the band were marching on the spot. No wonder I could still hear the band from inside the toilet. They were just on the other side of the wall. The sound was deafening. It rattled the windows and trolleys jiggled about all over the place. The floats had tried to get inside too. They must have just followed the one in front and not looked where they were going. The large dragon was stuck at the entrance, its head snapping and breathing fire and still playing Nelly the Elephant. The man with the big drum was outside, but his drum was inside, jammed in a revolving door. Nobody else could get in because all the doors were stuck, blocked by fat soldiers and euphoniums and other big instruments. Mrs. Owl just flapped about saying, "Oh dear, oh dear." There was still a smile on her face, but it wasn't a real one. Someone had to take charge. I thought as people had followed me into the toilet, they'd follow me out again. I ordered what was left of the Royal Marines to get in line. They seemed to think it was very funny until I told them to behave. I got all the brownies and guides back together and pointing towards the doors at the other end of the supermarket. These other doors opened onto a different road, but that didn't matter. I could still get to the park that way. Parade! I yelled. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. We left the supermarket to the sound of only small instruments and tappity drums. But everything was going to be great now, I just knew. I led the parade onto the other main road beautifully, just in time to crash headlong into the Boy Scouts and Cubs parade coming the other way. The road wasn't wide enough for two parades. Our bands and their bands barged into each other like bumper cars at a fairground. Everyone was mixed up. Then our big floats, the ones that hadn't been able to follow us through the supermarket and had gone a different way, bashed into their big floats. Everything came to a stop. The only movement came from my brownie pack, because we still had sweets to throw and cubs to throw them at. And when we ran out of sweets, we threw anything else we could find, and so did they. I didn't think I'd like brownies, but now I can't wait to go again. If a walk down the high street could be that much fun, what would camping and quad biking be like?
Imagine that, the whole parade stuck in the toilets. It's Only Annie is written by Tony and Jan Payne, and it's read by Katie Walker. We'll have more from the story tomorrow. Hello, if you've just joined me, it's Kirsten O'Brien here with the Little Toe Show. I hope you're not too scared of wild animals, because we're going to meet a few of them in our new story, Akimbo and the Crocodile Man, written by Alexander McCall Smith. Akimbo lives with his family in a big park in Africa, along with elephants, lions, and many other wild animals. And in this next adventure, he's about to welcome a guest into the ranger's camp.
Akimbo was sitting in his favourite cool place on the veranda, looking down the long, dusty track that led to the house. It was the middle of a hot African afternoon, and the bush was alive with the screech of insects. Overhead, the empty blue sky seemed to go on forever and ever. Nothing stirred. Suddenly, Akimbo saw a cloud of dust in the distance. He stood up, straining his eyes to get a better view. "Yes," he thought, "this is it. Look," he shouted to his mother, who was somewhere inside the house. "Look, our visitor is coming." Akimbo's mother joined him on the veranda. The dust cloud was bigger now, and they could see what was throwing it up as it bumped its way over the track. It was a large white truck. "Go off and tell your father," she said. "He will want to know that his guest has arrived safely." Akimbo ran down the path that led to the ranger station. He made his way to the half-open door with its chief ranger sign and peered in. "Our visitor is here," he said from the doorway. Akimbo's father looked up from his desk and smiled. He was clearly pleased to hear the news. "Good," he said. "So the Crocodile Man has arrived at last." When they got back to the house, the white truck had already drawn up at the front door. Akimbo and his father climbed the steps to the veranda, where they found the visitor sitting in one of the canvas chairs, sipping a cup of tea which Akimbo's mother had prepared for him after his long journey. Akimbo's father shook hands with the man, who then turned to Akimbo and gave him a friendly smile. "So you're Akimbo," he said. "I've heard a lot about you." Akimbo reached out shyly and shook the visitor's hand. "My name's John," said the man. Akimbo looked up at him. John was very tall, he noticed, and had a warm, friendly face. But there was something else which he noticed. All the way down his right arm, there ran a long, thick scar, punctured here and there by ridges, where wheals had healed up. Akimbo tried not to stare, but it was hard to avoid doing so. And John noticed the boy's gaze on his arm. "Yes," he said jokingly. "That was quite a bite." Akimbo looked away, embarrassed. But it was obvious that John didn't mind. "A crocodile," he said. "Not a big one, actually. It was only a couple of years old. But it took me by surprise, and it managed to make quite a mess before I dealt with it." Akimbo's father gave a shudder. "I've always kept well away from those creatures," he said. "I don't know what you see in them." John laughed. "But they are fascinating," he said. "They're the most interesting animals in Africa." Akimbo's father was not convinced. "Give me lions any time," he said, "or leopards, or any of the others we have. But crocodiles? No, thank you." Akimbo did not see their guest until supper time that night. His father took John across to the ranger station, and the two of them did not return until shortly before 7. As they sat down at the table and began their meal, Akimbo made every effort to keep his eyes off John's injured arm, but once again he found it hard to do so. How had the crocodile got him, he wondered. Had John been in the water or out of it when it happened? and had he saved himself, or had there been somebody there to help him? As the meal progressed, John turned to Akimbo and began to tell him about himself. "I'm a zoologist," he said. "I spend all my time studying animals and writing up my findings for people to read." Akimbo was fascinated. "Have you written a book?" he asked. John nodded. "Yes," he said. "I've written a book all about crocodiles." "I've seen it," chipped in Akimbo's father. "They have it in town." Akimbo was most impressed. He had never met anybody who had written a book before, especially a book about crocodiles. He wondered if he would be able to find it at his school. He doubted it somehow, as there were not many books in the school library, and those that were there seemed to be about science and mathematics and subjects like that. If only they had books about crocodiles. "And what are you going to be doing here?" asked Akimbo's mother. Like her husband, she did not like crocodiles either. The crocodile man sat back in his chair. "I'm going to be starting a project on egg hatching," he said. "I want to try and find out how many of the newly hatched crocodiles survive the first year of life." Akimbo was surprised to hear about the hatching. He did not even know that crocodiles laid eggs. It seemed so strange to think of a great creature like that coming from something as small as an egg. He wondered if you could eat a crocodile's egg, and whether it would taste at all like a hen's egg. He did not want to try this, but perhaps he would find out about it if he managed to get hold of a book on crocodiles. John went on to explain what he planned to do. He wanted to try to catch a female crocodile and all her baby crocodiles and to put tags on them. Then, a year later, he would return to the same spot and see how many of the tagged crocodiles could still be found in the area. This all sounded really interesting to Akimbo. But how did one tag a crocodile? He could not imagine that it would be easy. "Won't it be dangerous?" he asked. "I wouldn't like to try to catch the mother crocodile." John chuckled. "Yes," he replied. "It can be dangerous. In fact, that's how this happened." He pointed to his torn right arm, answering the question which Akimbo had been longing to ask. "We'll net them," John went on, turning to Akimbo's father. "I'll need 3 or 4 of your men," he said. "And perhaps you'd like to help as well." Akimbo's father raised his hands in horror. "No, thank you," he said, quickly adding, "but I'm sure that some of my men won't mind helping you." Akimbo saw his chance. "Nor would I," he blurted out. "I wouldn't mind coming." There was a silence at the table. The crocodile man turned and looked at Akimbo. "Are you sure?" he said. "I mean, I'd be very happy for you to come and watch." "I'd love to," said Akimbo as quickly as he could, casting a doubtful glance in his father's direction. Akimbo's father sighed. They had had this argument before, when Akimbo had insisted on going with him to catch a rogue lion which had been raiding cattle pens at the edge of the game park. That adventure had ended with the bringing back of a motherless lion cub. Would this one end with a pet crocodile wandering about the place? "Please," Akimbo begged. "Please say it's all right." Akimbo's father looked at the crocodile man, then back at his son. "Very well," he said. "But remember, I don't want you bringing back any little crocodiles." "I promise I won't," insisted Akimbo. "And I don't want any part of you bitten off," added Akimbo's mother sternly. "Not even a little finger." "I promise that won't happen either," said John, his eyes sparkling. And with that, it was settled. Akimbo would be a member of the Crocodile Man's team. They set off the next morning, just the two of them, Akimbo and his new friend John. It was a bright, warm morning, and as they travelled over the rough bush track, they disturbed a number of animals who were out finding food before the real heat of the day. They saw baboons and several families of warthogs, and as they turned a corner, a rhinoceros lumbered off into cover. As they travelled, John talked to Akimbo about crocodiles. "If you're going to be helping me with my crocodiles," he said, "then you should know something about them." Akimbo was eager to learn and listened intently as John told him all about the life of the strange reptiles. "They are just like any other animal," he explained. "Much of their life is spent looking for food and keeping warm." "Oh, so that's why they sunbathe," Akimbo said. He had seen crocodiles resting on sandbanks, soaking up the warmth of the sun like sunbathers on a beach. John nodded. "They're cold-blooded," he said. "They have to store up heat from the sun. That's why they lie so still. They don't want to waste any energy." There were other things, too. John told him how the crocodile grabbed its prey, seizing it in its great jaws and then twisting it round to tear off the flesh. "They have terrific powers in their jaws," he said. "But it's all directed to snapping the jaws closed. The muscles that open the mouth are much weaker." Akimbo was fascinated. He had not realized that there was so much to learn about crocodiles, and he could hardly wait to get to the river so that they could start their search. They stopped some distance short of the river itself. "I don't want to disturb them," John explained. "We should walk from here and keep our voices down as well. That way, if there are any crocodiles basking, we should be able to spot them." They parked the truck under some trees to keep it cool. Then, being as quiet as he could, John led Akimbo through the thick scrub that lay between them and the edge of the river. Akimbo took great care where he put his feet. His father had taught him that this was the secret of moving silently through the bush. There were always twigs or small branches that would crack loudly if you trod on them. The river at that point was fairly wide and moved slowly and sluggishly past reed-lined banks. Here and there, the surface of the water was broken by rocks, which jutted out like small islands along a coast. There were also sandbanks, spits of golden brown sand that dipped below the green surface of the water. These were ideal places for crocodiles to bask, as they offered all that they needed: warmth, a good view of what was happening on the river banks, and an easy way back into the water if danger presented itself. John crouched down and signaled to Akimbo to do the same. They were still a little way from the edge of the river, but they had good cover as well as an uninterrupted view of several sandbanks and places where the river widened out into deep, still pools. "This is an ideal place for them," John whispered. "If we stay here for a while, we are bound to see something." Akimbo settled down on the ground beside the crocodile man and watched the river in front of him. The water looked so smooth and peaceful that it was difficult to imagine anything as dangerous as a crocodile lurking below it. In fact, as he sat there, he thought how nice and cool it would be to swim. Yet he had only to glance at John's scarred arm to remind himself that swimming was not a good idea. For a long time, nothing seemed to happen. Akimbo began to wonder whether they would ever see anything. But John seemed to be quite happy to sit patiently watching the river, chewing at a blade of succulent green river grass, which he had plucked. Akimbo's attention had wandered, and he was looking at a group of chattering birds in a treetop when he felt John tug at his sleeve. "There," he said quietly, "on the other side." Akimbo looked in the direction in which John was pointing. On the other side of the river, a few paces away from a sandbank, a dark object was moving slowly across the surface of the water. "Two of them," John whispered. "The other one slightly behind." Akimbo had to search for a while, but at last he picked out the snout of the second crocodile. A few seconds later, the two crocodiles had reached the sandbar and had begun to lumber up out of the water. As they did so, Akimbo drew in his breath. "Yes," whispered John, "they are beauties, at least 5 meters each."
5 meters? That That's easily longer than a car. Find out what happens next in Akimbo and the Crocodile Man tomorrow. It's written by Alexander McCall Smith and read for us by Maynard Ezeyashi.
My toes are wiggling. It's little toad time.
There's only 10 minutes to go until we catch up with Black Beauty again. But it's time to meet Fergus again now in our story, Fergus Crane, by Paul Stewart and Chris Riddell. Fergus has just set off to save his friends from the scary pirates on Fire Island. But will his mechanical flying horse get him there safely?
Somewhere over the endless ocean, the day blurred into the next, with a long, cold night in between. Fergus slept, clinging tightly round the flying horse's neck. When he was hungry or thirsty, he sampled the exotic rations and delicious hot chocolate dispensed by the scuttlebug. Finally, after what Fergus would later describe as the longest flight of my life, he spotted land. Two rocky islands divided by a channel of water. The Stormy Straits, the gateway to the Emerald Sea. The horse flew into the wind, its wings beating powerfully, and it wasn't long before Fergus was able to see a patch of almost luminous green far in the distance. Closer and closer it came, until the air grew still, and below him the sea glinted like a vast slab of polished jade. And there were the islands. Fergus saw them, his heart leaping. Horseshoe Island and Magnet Island, and the air warm and scented with spices and herbs. The archipelago looked even more like a scorpion from above than it did on the map. Fergus counted off the islands, his heart thumping with excitement as the great winged horse followed the curve of the scorpion's tail. "There it is," Fergus whispered as the last island came into view. "Fire Isle." Fringed with glittering sand and with a tall volcano glowing at its centre, the island seemed to sparkle like a jewel in the half-light of the setting sun. Fergus pulled sharply on the reins. There was a familiar click from inside the horse's head as he took control. They circled the island, Fergus scouring the beaches for any sign of footprints. He could see the coconuts in the palms and the bulbous red and black nuts hanging from the spreading branches of the macadamia trees. Interesting, he thought, but not what he was looking for. Fergus steered the flying horse up over a rocky outcrop and gasped with surprise. On the other side was a small natural harbour, and there were the tall masts and furled sails of the Betty Jean. The flying horse landed on the foredeck. Fergus gratefully dismounted, stretched, and looked round. The ship seemed deserted.
"Hello?" he called. "Anybody aboard?"
From high above came a familiar squawk.
"Roar! Fergus! Fergus!"
Bolivia's voice floated down from the parrot's nest.
"You've come back! Roar!"
The parrot swooped down.
"Roar! They've gone!"
Bolivia squawked, settling on Fergus's arm.
"To the big mountain! Roar! Roar!"
"What's happened to you, Bolivia?" Fergus asked, concerned. The parrot looked bedraggled, bare patches at her neck and several tail feathers missing entirely.
"Rot, Captain Claw,"
said Bolivia.
"Eat me! Cook me! Parrot stew! Rot, rot!"
"The big bully," said Fergus hotly. "He doesn't deserve a fine bird like you." A cold wind was blowing round the top of the volcano. It hit the hot, smoky air emerging from the crater, and dark, gold-edged clouds gathered in the sky above. On the lip of the mighty volcano stood Captain Claw, a metal bucket on the end of an iron chain hanging from his hook. Further down, where the jungle lapped at the volcano's steep slopes, were four pairs of individuals standing beside four tiny potholes.
"When I blow this whistle," Captain Claw roared, "the tunnel exercise will begin."
He glared down at his crew. Lizzie Blood stood with a rope attached to a shocked-looking Sylvie Smith. Horace Tucker tried to smile.
his rope held by a yawning red-beard Spicer, while Short John Gilroy scowled and yanked at Spike Thompson's harness, causing the boy to scowl back. Mouse looked down at her feet. Beside her, one-eyed Jack Woodhead smiled nastily.
"When you filled this bucket with fire diamonds," Captain Claw bellowed, "your teachers will pull you to the surface. Is everybody ready?"
The pirates pushed their children towards the potholes. Captain Claw smiled malevolently. Then he placed his whistle in his mouth and blew. When Fergus heard Captain Claw's bellowed commands echoing far above his head, he groaned miserably. He had arrived too late. Fergus crawled forward. He had to know exactly what was going on. Before he'd gone far, he heard a noise to his left. There was someone there. Fergus paused, parted the branches, and peered out. Redbeard Spicer was just ahead of him, standing beside a pothole. Fergus frowned. The pirate was feeding a length of rope down into the pothole. Fergus stared in horror. At the end of that rope was one of his friends, Horace, if he had got his bearings right, and this was indeed the glory hole. Just then, the pothole belched a cloud of pungent yellow smoke into the air. Fergus gagged. Oh, it was the glory hole, all right. Fergus's jaw dropped as he saw the end of the rope suddenly flick through Spicer's hands.
"Glory hole away,"
he called up to Captain Claw. His voice was joined by the shouts of the other pirates.
"Big Dipper away!"
"Corkscrew away!"
"Devil's Pot away!"
Fergus's blood was boiling. Captain Claw had no intention of pulling the children to safety after the bucket was full. The ropes were just a cruel joke. Fergus turned and disappeared back into the jungle. The pirates were clustered round Captain Claw at the lip of the volcano, watching intently as he lowered the bucket into the crater's smoking depths. Far below, the children were crawling towards the fire caverns, unaware that the pirates had abandoned them to their fate.
"Scurvy deck swabbers,"
spat Lizzie Blood.
"I'm glad to be rid of them."
"Then we'll be rich beyond our wildest dreams,"
sniggered Short John Gilroy. Just then, the chain gave a jolt. Then another, and another.
"You little beauties," chuckled Captain Claw. "That's the job. Fill the bucket with fire diamonds."
He laughed again, and the others all joined in a chorus of hideous cackles, which collapsed into spluttering coughs as the volcano belched sulfurous smoke. A while later, the chain in the captain's metal claw gave a sharp lurch, followed by another.
"It's full!" cried Captain Claw. "Quick, haul it up!"
The pirates jumped to it, forming a line and grabbing the chain. Captain Claw moved to the back and gripped the end.
"One, two, three, and heave!"
he roared.
"Heave! Heave!"
Slowly, the heavy iron bucket rose through the clouds of eye-watering, breath-snatching fumes.
"Heave!"
roared Captain Claw for the final time as the bucket, glowing faintly from the intense heat, swung into view. At that same moment, from high above him, there came the sound of beating wings, and the smoke parted briefly to reveal a mighty winged horse hovering overhead. Captain Claw and the pirates stared at it, open-mouthed. Fergus Crane leaned forward in the saddle and looked down. Beside him was a large rock from the beach, the heaviest he could find. Fergus took aim and, grunting with effort, shoved the rock off the saddle. It hurtled down. Clang! It landed in the bucket full of fire diamonds, and the air echoed with the sound of chain rattling through grasping hands as the bucket plunged back down into the depths of the volcano.
"No!" roared Captain Claw. He held on with all his might. The other pirates did the same, digging their heels into the crumbly ash. But it was no good. The bucket was too heavy. They were tugged forward to the lip of the crater, howling and cursing, but refusing to let go.
Hell's haddocks!
Howled Redbeard Spicer, disappearing over the edge.
For certain starfish!
Cursed one-eyed Jack Woodhead, following him.
Heave, blast ye!
Captain Claw screeched, every muscle in his body straining.
Blood and gunpowder!
Screeched Lizzie Blood, as she too abruptly disappeared into the crater.
Pilch and stool!
Cried Short John Gilroy, joining her.
I won't let go!
Captain Claw snarled through clenched teeth.
The fire diamonds are mine!
He screamed as he followed the other pirates over the edge and down, down into the fiery heart of the volcano. The flying horse landed beside the nearest pothole. Fergus jumped down and without a second thought crawled into the hole. The tunnel plunged almost vertically. The air was oven hot and so thick with smoke Fergus could barely see his hands in front of his face. Carefully, he lowered himself, his feet braced against the jagged rock, towards the roaring of the volcano below. The deeper Fergus went, the hotter it became, the pungent fumes making his eyes water. It took all his strength to stop himself from plunging into the inky depths. Suddenly, the rock crumbled in clattering shards, and Fergus felt himself falling. The wind was knocked out of Fergus as he hit the bottom of the shaft. Shaking his head to clear his thoughts, Fergus looked about him. The narrow tunnel snaked away, its walls bathed in the fiery glow of the volcano. Fergus knew this place. It was bigger, hotter, and far more frightening than the tunnel in the ballast, but there was no doubt. This was the Devil's Pot.
Spike!
Fergus called.
Spike, are you there?
There was only the roaring of the volcano. Summoning all his courage, Fergus crawled towards the inferno. The tunnel grew narrower and narrower. Fergus squeezed his way along it until at last, grazed and gasping, he rounded the last bend. In front of him was the most spectacular sight he had ever seen.
Find out if Fergus and his friends survive in the next episode of Fergus Crane by Paul Stewart and Chris Riddell tomorrow. Fergus Crane was read by Stephen Kinman.
Listen out for a Wiggly Show. It's on twice a day. Call Little Toe.
Little Toe!
It's time for the next part of Anna Sewell's classic story, Black Beauty, now. Black Beauty is working for the Earl of Whitcomb and seems to be enjoying it. He even saved Lady Anne's life when her horse bolted. But can it all be so good?
I must now say a little about Reuben Smith, who was left in charge of the stables when York went to London. He was a first-rate driver. He could take a four in hand or a tandem as easily as a pair. Everybody liked him. Certainly the horses did. But he had one great fault, the love of drink. Early in April, Colonel Blantyre was obliged to return to his regiment, and it was arranged that Smith should drive him to town in the brougham, which was to be refurbished, and then ride back. I was chosen for the journey. We left the carriage at the maker's, and Smith rode me to the White Lion, and ordered the ostler to feed me well and have me ready for him at 4 o'clock. Smith didn't come into the yard till 5, and then he said he wasn't leaving till 6, as he'd met with some old friends. A nail in one of my front shoes had come loose, and the ostler told him about it, and asked if he should have the shoe attended to.
"No," said Smith. "It'll be all right until we get home."
He then went off and didn't arrive until nearly 9 o'clock, when he seemed in a very bad temper and abused the ostler, though I couldn't tell what for. Almost before he was out of the town, he began to gallop, frequently giving me a sharp cut with his whip, though I was going at full speed. The roads were stony, and going over them at this pace, my shoe became looser. When we were near the turnpike gate, it came off. If Smith had been in his right senses, he'd have noticed something wrong in my pace, but he was too drunk to notice anything. Beyond the turnpike was a long piece of road, upon which large, sharp stones had just been laid. Over this road, with one shoe gone, I was forced to gallop at my utmost speed. Of course, my shoeless foot suffered dreadfully. The hoof was broken and split, and the inside was terribly cut by the sharpness of the stones. This couldn't go on. The pain was too great. I stumbled and fell with violence on both my knees. Smith was flung off, and owing to the speed I was going at, he must have fallen with great force. I soon recovered my feet and limped to the side of the road. I could see Smith in the moonlight lying a few yards beyond me. It must have been nearly midnight when I heard a horse's feet, and I distinguished Ginger's step and the dogcart. I neighed loudly, and was overjoyed to hear an answering neigh from Ginger and men's voices. They came over the stones and stopped at the dark figure that lay upon the ground. One of the men jumped out.
"Oh, it's Reuben."
The other man followed and bent over him.
"Oh, he's dead."
They looked at me and soon saw my cut knees. Robert attempted to lead me forward. I made a step but almost fell again. It was agreed that Robert should lead me and that Ned must take the body in the dogcart. I'll never forget that night walk. It was more than 3 miles, and I limped and hobbled as well as I could with great pain. At last, I reached my own box. After Robert had wrapped my knees in wet cloths, he tied up my foot in a bran poultice to draw out the heat. The next day, after the farrier had examined me, he said he hoped the joint wasn't injured. If it was, while I shouldn't be spoiled for work, I'd never lose the blemish. The cure was long and painful. As soon as my knees were sufficiently healed, I was turned into a small meadow for a month or two. No other creature was there, and I felt very lonely. Then, one morning, the gate was opened, and who should come in but dear old Ginger? The man slipped off her halter and left her there. With a joyful whinny, I trotted up to her. But I soon found that she wasn't brought to me for our pleasure. Her story would be too long to tell, but the result was that she'd been ruined by hard riding and was now turned out to see what rest would do. Lord George was young and a hard rider, and he'd hunted whenever he could get the chance, quite careless of his horse. "And so," said Ginger, "here we are, ruined in the prime of our youth and strength, you by a drunkard and I by a fool. It's very hard." We used to stand for hours under one of the shady lime trees with our heads close to each other, and so we passed our time till the family returned from town. One day, we saw the Earl come into the meadow, and York was with him. They examined us carefully. The Earl seemed much annoyed.
"There's £300 flung away. But what I care about most is that these horses of my old friend who thought they'd find a good home with me are ruined. The mare shall have a 12-month's rest, and we'll see what that'll do for her. But the black one, he must be sold. It's a great pity, but I couldn't have knees like those in my stables."
"Of course not, my lord," said York.
"But he might get a place where appearance is not of much consequence and still be well treated.
I know the master of some livery stables in Bath, who often wants a good horse at a low figure. I know he looks after his horses well.
Then you'd better write to him, York. I'm more particular about the place than the money he'd fetch.
About a week after this, Robert came into the field with a halter, which he slipped over my head and led me away. There was no leave-taking of Ginger. We neighed to each other as I was led off. Through the recommendation of York, I was bought by the master of the livery stables. I had to go by train, which was new to me, and required a good deal of courage the first time. When I reached the end of my journey, I found myself in a tolerably comfortable stable and well attended to. Our master kept a good many horses and carriages of different kinds for hire. Sometimes his own men drove them. At others, the horse and chaise were let to gentlemen or ladies who drove themselves. Hitherto, I had always been driven by people who at least knew how to drive. But in this place, I was to get my experience of all the different kinds of bad and ignorant driving to which we horses are subjected. For I was a job horse and was let out to all sorts of people. It would take a long time to tell of all the different styles in which I was driven. There were the tight rein drivers, men who seemed to think that all depended on holding the reins as hard as they could, never relaxing the pull on the horse's mouth. There are the loose rein drivers, who let the reins lie easily on our backs and have no control over a horse if anything happens suddenly. There's the steam engine style of driving. These drivers seem to think that a horse is bound to go just as far and just as fast and with just as heavy a load as they please. Of course, we sometimes came in for good driving here. I remember one morning I was put into the light gig and taken to a house in Pulteney Street. Two gentlemen came out. The taller came round to my head and looked at the bit and bridle.
"Be so good as to take the curb off this horse. An easy mouth is a great thing on a long journey."
He patted my neck.
"Isn't it, old fellow?"
Then he took the reins and they both got up. I can remember now how quietly he turned me round, and we were off. I arched my neck and set off at my best pace. I found I had someone behind me who knew how a good horse ought to be driven. It seemed like old times again. This gentleman took a great liking to me, and after trying me several times with the saddle, he prevailed upon my master to sell me to a friend of his, who wanted a safe, pleasant horse for riding. And so it came to pass that in the summer, I was sold to Mr. Barry.
Another new owner. Find out how Black Beauty gets on with Mr. Barry tomorrow when John Hasler reads the next part of Black Beauty. The story's written by Anna Sewell. Can you believe it? We've wiggled through all our stories for today. But don't worry, I'll have you on your toes tomorrow with loads more exciting stories. Starting with a visit to Wiggly Park, then we've more from It's Only Annie, and then there's more from Akimbo and the Crocodile Man, Fergus Crane and Black Beauty. Now, what am I going to do with my toes till then? I know! Wiggle!
Online, bbc.co.uk/bbc7.
Hey there.